in a series of shows entitled, If God is One, Then Why Are There So Many Religions? It's been a couple of weeks since we had our last one, because we're getting ready for the Festival of India. But basically, the reason that there are apparently different religions is because of the considerations of time, place, and circumstance. You know, the message is one and absolute and timeless, and it's one God, but at the same time, the message has to be presented according to the time and the place and the audience. So you can't give them more than what they're prepared to digest or absorb. And so therefore we find the message is tailor-made according to different times and different places and circumstances. But the Vedic literature differs from other religious traditions in as much as it has no point of beginning. Christ, he came 2,000 years ago. He appeared before a certain audience, and he spoke in parables. He told them, I have many more things to tell you, but you're not ready for them. Muhammad came 1,300 years ago, and he preached in a certain context. Buddha was 2,500 years ago. He also preached in a certain context. Now, on one level, you could say the Vedic truths, as spoken by Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita, are 5,000 years old. That's when they were written down. But if you look at the Gita itself, Krishna says to Arjuna, the recipient of the Gita, that I originally spoke this message in the beginning of creation to the sun god Vibhishan. So that means as soon as the world was created, the message was spoken. Just like as soon as... What is all this racket? Just like as soon as this tape recorder was created, there was an instruction booklet that goes with it. So similarly, at the beginning of the creation of the world, the Lord spoke to the sun god, because nothing preceded the sun. Nothing can exist before the sun. The sun is a prerequisite for life. If there's no sun, there's no life. So we understand that when Krishna spoke to Vibhishan, it was in the very, very beginning of creation. And in fact, the knowledge that he spoke had to do with material nature, it had to do with the living being, it had to do with time, it had to do with the spiritual world. And the knowledge wasn't really dated, although it was imparted at a certain point of time. It's not dated. Like Christianity is named after Christ, Muslimism is named after Muhammad, Buddhism is named after Buddha, because these were personalities that appeared in specific dates in history. But the Vedas were originally imparted to the sun god. They were also originally imparted to Lord Brahma, the creator of the universe. And in fact, Veda means knowledge, and you can't put a date on knowledge. There isn't a point in time at which knowledge came into existence. Knowledge is always knowledge, all times, all places, all circumstances. 2 + 2 = 4 is always 2, is always 4. Gold is always gold, no matter where you find it. So certain things don't change. And that's the difference between Sanatan Dharma and religions which have a point of origin in time and place and circumstances. And as an example, when we discussed this in quite a lot of detail last week, when you compare the Bible in terms of the amount of detail it gives to that audience and that time and that place to the Vedic literature, you see that there's so much more information about the process of creation than there is in the Bible. Basically, the Bible, there are two sentences. It says, let there be light, and there was light. Let there be earth, and there was earth. And that's it. And if you want to know all the detail that's contained in the Vedic literature, just go back and reference our first talk a couple of weeks ago, and you can see that there's just a lot more information available in the Sanatan Dharma literature. Now also, in terms of what information we have about God himself, we'll find that the Vedic literatures are much more richly endowed. First of all, God itself just means power. It means control. It means one. But the word that we use is Krishna or Bhagavan. Bhagavan, like from Bhagavad Gita or Srimad Bhagavatam. Bhagavad Gita is the song of God. Srimad Bhagavatam is a beautiful story of the absolute truth. So that root word bhag means opulences. And van or vad means possessor of opulences. So God is defined as the possessor of opulences. And there are 6 main opulences that one has to possess in full in order to qualify as Krishna or God. They were originally listed by Parasara Muni in a verse Aishwarya samagrasya, viryasya, yasashastriya, jnanam vairagyaschapi, shanam bhagamitingana. To qualify to be God, and no two people can have all these opulences. Only one person can possess these opulences in full. To qualify for God, one must have all wealth, all strength, all fame, all knowledge, all beauty, and all renunciation. Aishwarya means opulences, samagrasya. Virya means strength, yashasha means fame, sriya means beauty, jnana means knowledge, and vairagya means renunciation. Krishna means that. It means all attractive by virtue of possessing six opulences here. And so we have them coming up on the screen one after another. He showed his strength by lifting Govardhan Hill, a graphic example or exhibition of his strength. He was only in his seventh year of his manifested pastimes. He was going to be on the planet for 125 years. This is only 7 years since he appeared in the prison house of Vasudeva and Devaki. And no ordinary seven-year-old boy has the strength to lift a mountain and hold it up a loop for 7 days. No ordinary boy does that. Even a mature man who takes steroids and lifts out in the weight in the gym, he might be able to lift the front end of a Volkswagen and hold it for 30 seconds, but then he has to drop it and go, pah! So the power and the strength with which Krishna lifted and held Govardhan Hill up for a week was not ordinary. It was not gained. It was innate. In other words, he's all powerful, whether he's exhibiting the form of a 7-year-old boy or a 16-year-old boy. His power is not dependent on his form. In this material world, a 7-year-old boy is very limited in power. When he gets to be 17, he has more power. When he gets to be 27, he's pretty much at his peak. 37, it begins to ebb. 47 less, 57 less, 67. He's feeble again as he was when he was originally 7. So our power waxes and wanes according to our body. But Krishna, even though he has only a 7-year-old body in this particular pastime, there are no limits to his power. He's all-powerful no matter what age he's exhibiting in his lila. And then that's followed by beauty, Kandarpa Koti, Kamaniya. The beauty of Krishna is such that millions and millions of cupids fall down and admit defeat in the face of his beauty. If Krishna would walk in the room, whatever part of his body or his eyes would fall upon, you would look at that eternally. Even a beautiful person with a material body, they walk in the room, and you might admire an arm. But after a minute or so, then you look at the shoulder. And then you check out the neck. And then you check out the lips. And then check out the nose and the forehead and the legs and the thighs and the waist and the chest and all like that. So your eyes will dart here and there. But every single part of Krishna's body, even his earlobes, even his little toe, has unlimited beauty. And so if your eyes, whatever part of his body your eyes happen to fall upon, you could look at that eternally. And your eyes would never become restless. They would never need to flirt with different parts of the body. See? That is the unlimited beauty of Krishna. And knowledge, you see him speaking here to Arjuna. Great stressful circumstance. There were 6.5 million soldiers ready to try and kill each other. They were all ready to engage in hostilities. Arjuna lost his nerve. And in that tense situation, Krishna kept his cool, and off the top of his head, he spoke the perennial philosophy of Bhagavad Gita. Ralph Waldo Emerson, one of the intellectual founders of the American Transcendentalist movement, and a great poet and a great author in and of himself, said that the Bhagavad Gita is such a great book of philosophy that it should be read on one's knees. And yet Krishna didn't make an outline, he didn't think about it, he didn't do any research, he just spoke it within a half an hour off the top of his head. And here is wealth. Krishna went to the east coast, west coast of Gujarat, the peninsula, and built his own city in which he had 16,000 palaces. And in those palaces there were jewels in the walls, the beds were laid with silk. And the opulence of even one of those palaces was unparalleled in the history of the world, and he had 16,000 of them. Sometimes people object. They say, "Well, wealth, you know, that's like a mundane opulence. You know, don't you bring God down a notch by saying that he's wealthy?" Well, in the material world, wealth often brings with it a smell. You see, most people get wealthy by cutting corners and practicing aggression and dishonesty and stepping on other people's toes. But when you have all wealth, when you created everything, you're the source of everything and the owner of everything, then that's no longer mundane. That's wealth of a whole different caliber altogether. And wealth of that sort is, in fact, transcendental. Even Donald Trump, you know, he has wealth, but other people have wealth, and other people, he doesn't have all wealth. He doesn't have all wealth, and usually the wealth that he has, he got it at the expense of other people. Some people have more than what they need, and some people have less than what they need. But Krishna created everything. Essentially, he owns everything, and his advice to us is to enjoy what is set aside as our quota and leave the rest knowing well to whom it belongs. So he's given each and every one of us the basics, basic food, basic shelter, but we haven't been satisfied with that. We've been greedy, we've taken more than our quota. And that means because everyone has a certain quota, when one person takes more, it means there's other person doesn't get their basic quota. Otherwise, he's created unlimited wealth, and he's not claiming it, he's not securing it, he's not prohibiting us from using it, he's inviting all of us to use it, he's only asking us to share it equally. But apparently we're not up to the task. And then renunciation. Again, he's created this world full of mountains and oceans and jewels and gold mines and beautiful sunsets and oceans and beaches. And he basically allows us to even misuse it. If you give someone your car and you see they're driving it too fast and peeling rubber and turning around the corners and taking chances, you get upset at that. You're attached to the car and you expect that when someone borrows it, they treat it with the same respect you do. And when you say that's not the case, you want to take the car back. Well, Krishna doesn't do that. He gives these whole material universes. He allows the independent souls who don't want to surrender to him to populate the universes. And then, however much they misuse it, however much they pollute it, however many toxins they spew into the atmosphere, he doesn't take it back. He doesn't get upset. He doesn't get uptight. Even though we don't treat it with the same respect that he would treat it with. Basically, he said, okay, I've given it to you. It's yours. Take care of it. Be good stewards of it or mess it up. It's up to you. I'm not going to get involved. So he's detached. Of course, his best wish for us is that we do treat everything properly and we treat our bodies properly and the bodies of other people properly. And he gives endless advice in scriptures and through great saints and sages. He comes personally. He tries to communicate to us from within the heart what's the difference between right and wrong. But ultimately, he lets us have our own lead. And that would not be possible unless he was completely detached and renounced. And lastly, famous. Krishna is famous, especially as a child. It's interesting that when the fame picture comes up, we see Krishna as Makhan Chor, stealing yogurt and butter and putting it in his mouth. It's the childhood pastimes of Krishna which are most celebrated in India. Not so much the universal form or not so much Krishna at Kurukshetra. Of course, at Kurukshetra, Krishna's knowledge is, of course, celebrated, what he spoke in Bhagavad Gita. But otherwise, in terms of the performing arts or stories or literature, there's so much that's charming and irresistible about Krishna's childhood pastimes. And this is what has made Krishna more famous even than Lord Shiva, even the Lord Vishnu. It's the enchanting nature of his childlike pastimes. Vaibhavi and I were in Kerala a few years ago at the time of their annual arts festival. And they have performing arts and dance and drama on 20 different locations and stages and halls throughout the city. The main venue was a tent, a huge tent on the beach there in Cochin. And the tent would hold 5,000 people, and there was a big stage. And we were there on a Saturday, which was the main day. The festival goes on for 3 weeks, but Saturdays are obviously the biggest days. And they had Kuchipudi. Kuchipudi is one of the 6 or 7 classical dance styles of India. And they had competitions. Every performer had a number. And they had the boys from 10 to 1. They had an hour break. And then the girls went from 2 in the afternoon to 1 in the morning. And each girl or each performer had about 12 minutes to perform. And there were certain required elements. Kuchipudi, you have to dance on a plate. And then you have to also hold a plate on your head while you're dancing. There are certain required elements. And one of the required elements is to tell a Krishna story. And 9 out of 10 had to do with baby Krishna. 9 out of 10 had to do with baby Krishna. The older Krishna kidnapping Rukmini, fighting Sisupal, or counseling Arjuna, revealing his universe. Those were less often chosen than the childhood pastimes of Krishna. So Krishna has achieved fame even above Vishnu and Shiva and other avatars because of his beautiful, charming childhood pastimes. So here are some other areas in which the Vedic system seems to be less limited, less restricted than other systems of knowledge. In the area of mathematics, Indians discovered arithmetic and geometric progression. Arithmetic progression is explained in the Yajurveda, which was, again, written 5,000 years ago. In fact, geometry is a Sanskrit word, gyamati, and it means the study of angles. So it's quite clear that the English science of geometry has originated with the Sanskrit. Govinda Swami discovered Newton-Gauss interpolation formula about 1,800 years before Newton. Vateshwacharya discovered the Newton-Gauss backward interpolation formula about 1,000 years before Newton. More information, Parameshwaracharya discovered Luyer's formula about 400 years before, I don't know how to pronounce it, L-H-U-I-L-E-R. Nilakant discovered Newton's infinite geometric progression convergence series. Positive and negative numbers and their calculations were explained first by Brahmagupta in his book Brahmasputra Siddhanta. Aryabhata propounded the heliocentric theory of gravitation, predating Copernicus by almost 1,000 years. I was at there's a high school at Olympus High School. It's not even a high school; it's an elementary school up on the east bench there in Salt Lake City. And they asked me to do a PowerPoint presentation on Vedic culture, and then we did some chanting. So I was talking about this very area, the superiority and the antiquity of Vedic science and mathematics. And so I told them that the zero was invented from the Vedic system. The decimal system comes down to us from Indian culture. And these are all kids, just young kids, I don't know, maybe 7, 8, 9, 10 years old. And I could tell that when I told them that the decimal system was invented in India, they weren't particularly impressed. Their attention was wandering a little bit. When I said that zero, the system of zero, comes to us from Indian culture, they weren't particularly impressed. And then I said, the Indians invented pi. And then I knew, and then I saw I had their attention. And I didn't want to explain, you know, the misunderstanding right there. I thought I would just have a little fun with it and let the teacher sort it out a little bit later. So I said they invented the decimal system, no reaction, boredom. They invented zero, boredom. They invented pi. And then they said, ooh, they invented pi. And I said, yeah, without the Indians you wouldn't have chocolate pie, peach pie, apple pie, you know. And then I got their attention. Oh, wow, you know, that's a great culture, you know. We really owe them a lot, you know. Continuing on here. A textbook on astronomy of ancient India, last compiled in 1000 BC, believed to be handed down from 3000 BC by aid of complex mnemonic recital methods still known today. Thousands of years ago, it was calculated that the diameter of the Earth was 7,840 miles. And that's only 80 miles off from the modern astronomer's calculation of 7,926. And then thousands and thousands of years ago, the Vedic literatures tell us that the moon is 253,000 miles away. And modern measurements are 252,710. So that's a difference of only 290 miles. And this was 600 years before Christ that they came up with these figures. Again, pi, this is what really got the kids' attention. The first pie was cooked by Bodhiana, and it was an apple pie. And he also explained the concept of the Pythagorean theorem. In other words, that even Pythagorean theorem is predated Pythagoras himself. That was the 6th century, long before European mathematicians. And it was validated by British scholars in 1999 that pi was formulated in India. Again, trigonometry, the study of triangles, is a Sanskrit word. That, along with algebra and calculus, came from India. Quadratic equations were propounded by Sridharacharya in the 11th century. Now, the largest numbers the Greeks and the Romans used were 106, whereas Hindus used numbers as big as 10 to the 53rd powers, with specific names as early as 5,000 BC during the Vedic period. Even today, the largest number used is Tara, or 10 to the 12th power. I love these little sound effects here. So why do we worship Krishna as the Supreme? Is he the same God that people talk about in Christianity and Muslimism? Or is this some different personality that we've concocted up? And I'm not sure what's actually coming forward here. That's why I don't use these transitions in my own shows. Do we worship Krishna out of fear? Do we worship Krishna because we want stuff? Do we worship Krishna out of duty? Or do we want to worship God out of love? Isn't it a fact that if you love someone, then you'll automatically do your duty towards them? You'll also desire to be with them. And if you have fear, it'll be fear of displeasing them. It won't be fear of being punished by them. But you love them so much that your greatest fear is doing something displeasing to them. So the difference, the shift, it's the same God, but there's a shift in devotion. In the Judeo-Christian world, there's a lot of what's going to happen to me if I don't do the right thing? What's going to happen to me if I don't follow the laws and all the shout nots? And also, what benefit do I get from it when I go to the church? Do I bring my shopping list and do I say, God, I've been a good little boy and girl, so therefore you please give me this and give me this or give me this. Or, thank you for giving me this, thank you for giving me this, thank you for giving me that. It's all about me. It's what I get from it or what I suffer because of failure to follow the God's law. Whereas if you feel genuine love for the Lord, if love awakens in a personal way for the Lord, then it's all about the Lord. It's no longer about you. How is the Lord see what I'm doing? Is it pleasing to the Lord? Is it displeasing to the Lord? And the fear then becomes of doing something which would cause that relationship to suffer. You see. So that's a difference in emphasis. When Jesus Christ says, love God with all your heart, all your soul, and all your mind. Well, it's very hard to love someone that you don't know much about. It's very hard to love someone of whom you have very, very little information. Now, a Christian will say, we love Jesus Christ. And that's fine. You should love Jesus Christ. But he's the guru. He's not God. He never claimed to be God. So you can't play this pinochle game where you're substituting one thing for another. Christ himself says love God. Christ doesn't say love me with all your heart and soul and your mind. Of course we love him because he's our guru. He models saintly behavior and naturally we love him, but But he himself is saying, love the Father with all your heart and all your soul and all your might. So he's not talking about loving himself. He's talking about loving another person. But if you don't know anything about that person, how are you going to love them? I mean, you can love them from the ears up, but where is the affair of the heart? With the deity worship, the system of worshiping the deity, the authorized deity, where the form of the Lord is carved according to scriptural descriptions and the visions of great saints and sages, and there's an authorized process of offering flowers, of dressing the deity, of offering your food to the deity beforehand, singing to the deity, doing the Arctic ceremony punctually with flowers and fruits and waters back to the Lord. This is a very, very personal type of worship. And so there's no ambiguity, there's no equivocation, there's no confusion about who God is and how we can act in such a way as to increase our love for Him. So the benefit of any religious system, the benefit, the how we judge its benefits is according to this one principle. Does it culminate in love of God? And love of God is defined as being uninterrupted and unmotivated. Uninterrupted and unmotivated. So if a religious system brings its adherents to the point of unmotivatedly and uninterruptedly 24/7 loving and serving God, then that's a good system. That's a good system. But if it doesn't bring them to that point, if they're motivated in their service, and if their service is intermittent, and they can't graduate or evolve beyond that, then that's the point at which that system needs to be transcended. That's the point at which that system needs to be left behind. Because if you're not developing love of God, you're not realizing the goal of life. And you're not going to be fulfilled as an individual. So the Vedic system does not encourage people to worship God for some motivation to get something in return, nor does it encourage them to worship Him intermittently. You know, if we're walking down the street and a gang comes up and they're going to beat us up and steal our wallet or maybe even shoot us, then we hope and we pray with fervent devotion, with intense devotion, that the policeman will appear on the scene. And if the policeman appears on the scene, we're overjoyed and we'll hug the policeman and we'll say, you saved my life. But then we don't care to have an ongoing relationship with the policeman. We just invoke him when we get in trouble, and as soon as he saves us, then we want nothing more to do with the policeman. So that's called interrupted, intermittent devotion to the Lord. And it's also called motivated, that I invoke you when I get into trouble. I'm not serving you spontaneously 24/7. Why would anyone serve God spontaneously 24/7? Because that's what we're made to do. We are created by God to serve Him in love and devotion. Not sometimes, and not for our own personal agenda, but just because we are constitutionally servants of God. The hand is made for only one purpose. It's made to serve the whole body by putting food into the mouth and reaching the stomach. That's the whole reason that the hand exists. If the hand thinks it'll enjoy separately, it loses its meaning, it loses its value, it loses its purpose, and it's not capable of enjoying separately. It has meaning and value only insofar as it serves the whole. So why do we serve God uninterrupted and unmotivatedly? Because that's what we're made to do. That's how we become fulfilled and happy in life. So here we have, what do we have? I have no idea. Goodness? Oh, these are the three modes of material nature. And these provide our motives. These are material motives for which one may worship God. One may worship God being motivated by the mode of goodness. Goodness is love for philosophy, a compassion for other living beings, poetry, an appreciation for beauty. We may relate to God in nature and through the beautiful things of this created world. And that's a motivation for worshiping God in goodness. Then going down a rung, there is the mode of passion. You can see these basketball players bumping each other, and from the looks on their faces. In fact, one of them is Charles Barkley, I think, the guy in the back. Anyway, they're intensely endeavoring to get the edge over their competitors. The rat race, survival of the fittest, the process of natural selection. They see God as a bigger, stronger animal than them. And so everything is about passion and unnatural effort and striving. And then the last and lowest of the three modes of nature is the mode of ignorance. And mostly people in the mode of ignorance, they like to sleep, they're indolent, they take intoxicants, they're subject to hallucinations. And sometimes they may even elevate their hallucinations to a so-called quasi or pseudo-religious experience. So living entities are generally influenced by one or another of these modes of material nature at all times. And unless one transcends these modes of material nature, one cannot actually love God in the way that God is meant to be loved and in the way that we're created to love Him, which is unmotivatedly and uninterruptedly. And there are different types of worship, you see. In the middle, it's hard to see the screen here because there's so much light. In the middle is Lord Vishnu, who presides over the mode of goodness. On your left is Lord Brahma, who presides over the mode of passion. Lord Brahma creates the universe. And on the right is Lord Shiva, who presides over the mode of ignorance. And there are different worships, like these religious people that cut off the heads of chickens. That's worship in the mode of ignorance. It's worship in the mode of ignorance. Enough said about that. And Lord Shiva presides over there. Here they're even making a human sacrifice. The worshippers of Kali in India, they eat meat and sometimes they sacrifice animals and sometimes they even sacrifice human beings. So that is worship in the mode of ignorance. I don't know what this picture is. Maybe it'll explain. Those fond of material prosperity approach Shiva for benedictions. Yeah, there are so many stories of materialistic, demoniac personalities who approach Lord Shiva for a material benediction. They never approach Lord Vishnu because Lord Vishnu is in the mode of goodness. They approach Lord Shiva because they are in the mode of ignorance and Lord Shiva presides over the mode of ignorance and they want boons from the mode of ignorance. Generally, they're boons of how to, you know, tyrannize and overpower and victimize other living beings. And they approach Lord Shiva by performing severe austerities. Vrikasura, for instance, cut flesh from his body until such time as Lord Shiva took pity on him and appeared before him and asked him, "What do you want? What do I have to give you in order to make you stop mutilating yourself like that?" The followers of Lord Shiva also are known for smoking things like bhang or charas or marijuana. They wear the long dreadlocks and they smoke the ganja in India, which is also in the mode of ignorance. And they also offer animals or chickens and sacrifice to please cow. So this is worship, but it's worship in the mode of ignorance. Not all religious systems are on the same level. Now here's Hiranyakashipu, who worshipped in the mode of passion. He again did austerities for 125 celestial years. So severe the austerities he did were that while he was standing on one leg, suspending his breathing with his arms in the air, ants built a colony around his body and consumed his flesh so that his life air was circulating within his bones. Ultimately, Lord Brahma came before him. You see Lord Brahma in the swan carrier. Lord Brahma was appalled at the extensive austerities that Hiranyakashipu had done. He said, "Look, what do I have to do to get you out of this?" And then Hiranyakashipu asked a whole bunch of benedictions. And in the mode of goodness and in transcendence, one asks for benedictions which will do good to people. Are you here for the yoga? You're here for the yoga? Okay, well, let's just wind this up, and Ram's there, your yoga teacher. But in the mode of passion, they benefit themselves at the expense of other people. And then worship in the mode of goodness, and we'll just wind this up this week, and we'll talk. And then next week, we'll talk about pure devotional worship called LDS, loving devotional service, which is above goodness, it's above passion, it's above ignorance. But in the mode of goodness, And devotees also worship Vishnu because Vishnu presides over the mode of goodness. And some of the elements of the worship are offering tulsi. These are the tulsi bushes here, which are very dear to Lord Vishnu. The leaves are offered to him, especially with food offerings. The water is offered in love, as it's recommended in Bhagavad Gita. The most essential ingredient is love, and that love is unmotivated. We're not worshiping Vishnu in order to get something in return. But we are worshiping Vishnu in order to get something in return. But what we are asking is, give us more service. Because that's what we are. We're servants. So give us more service. Don't allow us to make you our servant, but you keep us mindful that we're your servant. And the result of that worship is that the heart becomes purified. And then doing all those things under the guidance of a pure devotee, one can, from goodness, one can transcend the three modes and go back home, back to Godhead. So goodness is not transcendental per se, but it's like the airport from which you can take off. When you go to Salt Lake International Airport, that doesn't mean you're in London, but it's a prerequisite. You have to go to the airport first before you can get to London. So your worship has to elevate from ignorance and passion to goodness before one is eligible to taste what it is like to worship Lord Vishnu or Lord Krishna in pure devotional service. So we'll stop there.